Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. I'm Bill Lorton Smith, your host for this evening, and we have three guests with us tonight, and our topic is the new exhibition at the Allentown Art Museum of the Lehigh Valley. And our guests this evening, I'd like to welcome John Pepper, and John is the Adult Education Coordinator at the museum. And then secondly and thirdly, we have two distinguished visitors who will be presenting, making presentations in conjunction with the exhibition. And we have Diane Husick. She's a prof at Moravian College and also Nurture Nature Center. And in addition, we have Barbara Malt, who is a vice president of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society and a prof at Lehigh University. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
John, let's start with you a little bit. The new exhibition at the museum opened about a week, I think last weekend, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I've been open 1 week so far. And the exhibition is American Wildlife Art. And I think it's a little bit of a change from some of the typical exhibitions at the museum. I mean, continuing your recent trends of diversification and perhaps getting to a larger population, larger audience to come to the museum. Tell us how this particular exhibition came to pass.
Well, this exhibition began with a presentation by David Wagner to our former director, Brooks Joyner, who they had known each other because David had worked with Brooks before on two successful exhibitions for the Joslin Museum in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay, and I believe, obviously, they must have been pretty popular exhibitions for him.
They were.
When he arrived here to decide, hey, this is something we should do in Allentown. And I think a wildlife exhibition is particularly appropriate for this area, I believe.
Correct, yeah. There's a lot of interest in birds, for example, and the history of Audubon in the area.
Yeah, okay, so great. And tell me a bit about the selection criteria for inclusion in this exhibition. I know you have a guest curator, David Wagner,
right.
We just talked about,
right.
And he's published a hardback book of the same name that's a companion. Are the works in the exhibition, are they entirely covered in the book, or is there more in the exhibition? Or?
Many of those that are in the book are included in the exhibition, but I think the exhibition goes a lot further, and I think it's a large exhibition. It fills our two major galleries, and it's a lot of fun besides that.
How many paintings are included?
I can't tell you the paintings. I can't tell you the number of each, but it's a complete range of painting, print, sculpture, and from the very beginnings of wildlife art on this continent through contemporary art.
And covering how many centuries?
A good four centuries, I'd say.
Wow. Pretty impressive. So I suspect there's quite a large evolution in style over that spectrum as well, Mother.
It's a very interesting show that does. It really covers how the artists actually have adapted and moved mostly from scientific recording right through conservation, through contemporary and ecological movements. And it also shows how artists have influenced our opinions and our attitudes on wildlife.
And I think that plays into some of the presentations that we will be talking about later on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly art as an influencer of public opinion and engaging the public in a particular topic. David Wagner, was he here for the opening, or will he be here during the course of the exhibition?
Yeah, David was here for the opening, and he actually gave a talk on September 29th. And as guest curator, he was able to select artworks that really show how wildlife art aligned with other art movements of the time and contrasted as to like how it's been independent, too. I think for me, one of the most interesting things to remember is that early on, when this was just starting, inhabitants didn't know where the end was. They didn't know where the edge was. This was a new continent with all new animals to record.
So basically, as a function of time for this country, and it is American wildlife art, then there are more species appear as they actually got discovered on the American continent, right? Yeah, interesting.
Audubon, in fact, set out to paint all the birds of North America, but it was a discovery process for him. He traveled across the continent and looked for the birds and then painted them.
Okay. And we have paintings from Audubon in the exhibition, I assume,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yes. How could there not be? John, you lead a weekly guided tour of the exhibition, pointing out some of its particular highlights, at least presumably your view of the highlights of the exhibition. Tell us about the tour you give and when you give it, and tell us about some of the ones which are your particular highlights.
Okay, well, we do a Friday guided tour every Friday at 2 p.m., and we're calling it our Go Wild Fridays. It's actually timed so that you can come to the museum and enjoy a nice lunch from by our caterer, Karen Hunter, who actually has some wild-themed foods for the occasion. And then at 2 o'clock, we do the walkthrough tour. It's a nice gallery, pretty fast-paced gallery talk. And for me, this is really very interesting because I've been involved with the outdoors all my life. And Pennsylvania also has a great history of wildlife conservation, and it's also fun to just see some different examples of how specific artists have interpreted the outdoors and wildlife.
Interesting, yeah, yeah. I assume most, trying to think, I assume we don't go as far as any surreal depictions of the American wildlife in the exhibition, right? They're all pretty much lifelike.
You might think they are, but there is a contemporary edge to the show too that shows what artists are doing today. There's a historical segment and a contemporary segment.
Wow. Okay. So it really does cover a superb spectrum. How about any of your particular favorite picks?
Well, I don't. I can break
or rarities,
it down by
maybe.
Artists. Yep. Artists, maybe. I'm. Certainly interested in Audubon. Audubon is a great study as to what incredible power of observation he had, as well as incredible distribution. And we're actually going to be covering Audubon in another way, on another talk on November 17th with Robert McCracken Peck from the Natural History Museum in Philadelphia. He is going to be talking specifically about Audubon's last excursion. But some of the other artists involved are, I have to think of some names here, sorry. Arthur Tate, who was someone who specifically tried to imitate a painter he knew was one of Queen Victoria's favorites, and he specialized in these huge everyday sporting scenes and camp scenes that became popular as hunting became a popular leisure activity, and he captures these great majestic scenes and wildlife with a little bit of a Hudson River School approach. Another one later on is Carl Runge, who's a German-born artist who became an American, and he paints very much like a post-impressionist. He's capturing the moment, and he's slightly abstracting things. And this is sort of connected to the conservation movement that Teddy Roosevelt made popular in the early 20th century.
Good, excellent. I think we'll get a little bit more discussion of that coming up. You just prompted my question. It is the exhibition is entitled American Wildlife Art, but does that mean it's wildlife that exists in North America, or does it mean it's American artists, or both?
Wildlife that exists in North America.
Okay. So that explains then the sort of the evolution as more wildlife became apparent and known as we spread across the continent. All right, excellent. Let's start talking about the exhibitions, and there are a number of exhibitions. I think there's four different exhibitions happening as part of the, in conjunction, and tonight we have two of the presenters of those exhibitions, and we have Diane Husick, and Diane will be making her presentation, remind me, Diane?
On December 8th at 1 p.m.
December 8th, okay, yep. Very good. And you will be covering the title of your presentation?
Intersections Between Science, Nature, and the Arts.
Okay, excellent area, and basically trying to get over some scientific ideas by using the medium of art to make a connection.
Right. And historically, science and the arts weren't necessarily separate like we think about it today. And in fact, the separation that's occurred more recently in the 20th century by C.P. Snow, who was a chemist and a controversial author, felt that the split between the science and the arts or the humanities was really a problem because they were needed to work together to solve some of the world's problems. And so what I'll be doing is taking a look at some of the examples in the exhibit, such as those by Mark Catesby, who wrote basically the first naturalist history of the wildlife of North America in the 1700s, the flora and the fauna. And his work was actually used by Carl Linnaeus, who we think about in the science world as the person who was the father of zoology and taxonomy. And another exhibitor or represented in the exhibit is Alexander Wilson, who was a poet, a naturalist, and an illustrator, who's also considered the father of American ornithology, and so the science of birding. And so looking at that historical merging of the fields, as well as why do they separate and why do we need to have these come back together today?
Yeah, okay. And of course, one thing that prompted me, all of the guidebooks, at least all of the early bird guidebooks, seem to be really dependent on the quality of the artist depicting all of the fine details. And I don't know, I guess ornithology wouldn't be where it is without all of the great artwork that supported it, right?
Right. And I think the images that people see in guidebooks is really what gets them excited. They're beautiful, and you want to go out and find them in nature and see what inspired the person to paint that image.
I think you're also looking to, you've already talked about seeing as the intersection of art and science, but you're seeing the arts as a vehicle to engage the public in conversation about our current environmental problems, and I think that's pretty appropriate right now with the latest climate report just right. Come out last week. Tell us more about that.
So I do a lot of work in climate change, and you can take all the data in the world and throw it at people, and they don't want to listen. Their eyes glaze over, or they want to debate you. And a couple years ago, I was in Copenhagen when they had the United Nations climate meetings there, and they had turned the city into basically an art museum. It was on the streets and the buses. And the most iconic example was the frozen ice sculpture of a polar bear, which melted during the 2 weeks of the meeting because they were having record high temperatures. And that's what got me thinking about this intersection again, this way that art can reach an audience in ways that scientific data cannot.
Are there some particular examples of the artwork in the exhibition that you think are particularly useful in this manner?
I'm going to actually give some examples that are not in the exhibit. So, for instance, the traditional Audubon prints are being used by people now who paint over them with images of invasive species, strangling the iconic images of Audubon to call attention to how we're changing our environment. And they're pretty dramatic because people recognize the Audubon prints. But they are like, wait a minute, what's this vine that's just strangling this falcon?
And there are some of those, any of those included in this exhibition?
No, I'll have it in my talk.
But you'll have some, okay, all right. So added incentive, mm-hmm. Come to your talk, right?
Right.
Any other comments you'd like to make about your presentation?
You mentioned the Nurture Nature Center in Easton, and that's who I'll be representing. And they're basically founded on the idea of bringing art and science together to engage the community in dialogue. And so they have an upcoming exhibit right now on basically how people see the world after post-Sandy. So an artist exhibit that opens up on Thursday. They have a whole series of nature journaling workshops to get people looking at nature more closely again and think about what's changing in their backyards, and using that both as an artistic and scientific record of what's happening right in our backyard and in our region today.
Okay, and for more information about those activities, they have a website, right?
Yeah, if you just Google Nurture Nature Center, that'll come up, and that links to another project we call the Eastern Phenology Project for Pennsylvania, or Eastern Pennsylvania Phenology Project, which is at the Lehigh Gap Nature Center website.
Okay, excellent. And again, the date of the presentation?
December 8th.
December 8th.
At 1 p.m.
Which is a
Sunday.
A Sunday. Okay. Good time to get down there. And I think, am I right, the museum is free on Sundays as well?
The museum is free. The museum is free, but the talks are ticketed events.
Yeah, okay.
So it really
makes sense.
It really is best to try to reserve if you can.
Yep. See the exhibition and then go to the talk separately.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Let's get on and speak with Barbara. Barbara Malt. And she will also be making a presentation. And Barbara, the title of your presentation and when will that be happening?
My talk is Birds of the Lehigh Valley, and it will be on October 12th, and this one is at noon.
October 12th, so that's coming up this Saturday.
Saturday, yes,
at noon. Okay, right, so we are really timely. And the presentation will be?
About?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be about several key points. I'll talk about some of the backyard birds that people are generally familiar with, but then move into what's the diversity and range of birds that we get here in the Lehigh Valley, because this is actually an excellent place for bird watching. People may be familiar with the excellent raptor migration or hawk migration that we get along the Kittatinny Ridge. We're also in a major migratory path for songbirds and waterfowl, as well as having a lot of breeding birds here in the Lehigh Valley. So I'll introduce people to the diversity of birds that we do get here.
And are most of those covered in the exhibition, the particular birds? Good examples? Are there some particular rarities you will be hitting that have appeared in the Lehigh Valley of late or are coming back into the Lehigh Valley?
Well, I will highlight some of the birds that are in the exhibition that we can see here at home. And I counted up there's about 18 species depicted in the artwork that actually are reasonably easy for people to see here in the Lehigh Valley. Some of the ones that I will talk about will include the little heron that is on some of the advertising that the museum has been sending out for the exhibit.
This is a yellow heron, right?
No, it's not.
It's not.
No, it's not. It's called a green heron.
Thank you. Distinct from the large blue heron, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's so people are probably most familiar with the great blue heron, which is a fairly common heron around wetlands in this area. But we also are home to the green heron, which is one of the smallest herons in North America. And it has a kind of greenish back and some rusty on its nape. It's actually kind of a colorful little heron. And you can find it along the edges of ponds and creeks here in the valley.
All right, excellent. If some of your audience would like to get out there and see some of these birds directly themselves in person, what are your recommendations for that?
Well, I'll be giving some tips in the talk, so I hope people will come hear about them. But also, they can, if they'd like to go on some guided walks, they can just Google Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. And we run a range of free guided walks all year long, more in spring and fall, but really all year. And we would love to see more people come and join us.
Okay, and I just Google it, or the website is just at lvaudubon.org?
The easiest, if you just Google Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, you'll find it.
Okay. You're not by any chance doing a walk in downtown Allentown after your presentation, are you?
No, the number of species downtown would be kind of limited, but we do have walks on probably both Saturday and Sunday of this weekend, so take a look.
There is something I think you were going to mention, the PPL building has now become home to...
Yes, we do now have breeding peregrine falcons in Allentown, and they were first brought to breed on the PPL building. I'm not sure that they've returned to PPL most recently. They've been breeding at the 8th Street Bridge in Allentown.
So maybe people should bring their binoculars and after your presentation, get out in downtown.
Yep. Take a look. Yes, there are some exciting things downtown.
Good, excellent. Lots of interesting things happening in conjunction with the exhibition itself and these presentations. The exhibition already began, and John, the exhibition runs until?
Runs through December.
Okay. Allentown Art Museum of the Lehigh Valley, down on 6th Street, if you've not been there since the renovations. Oh, 5th Street, I'm sorry. 5th Street. Got my numbers wrong. If you haven't been down there since the renovation when it reopened a couple of years ago, definitely should get down for the exhibition. John, we are going to talk right after after these brief messages. We're going to talk a little bit about one other exhibition that's happening, and we'll have just a couple of just a minute or two on that exhibition of the Hidden Treasures of Photography.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Kutztown University Presents, announcing a new season of entertainment with former Fleetwood Mac guitarist Rick Vito, Thursday, October 24th, and a cappella group Pentatonix, Saturday, October 26th, and Signature Broadway, featuring current Broadway performers doing everything from Rodgers and Hammerstein to Sondheim. Details at kutztown.edu/music.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Sovereign Performing Arts Center, announcing the Barefoot Contessa coming to Reading, Ina Garten, cookbook author and star of Food Network's Barefoot Contessa, will be sharing her tips, stories, recipes, and answering audience questions Wednesday, November 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Sovereign Performing Arts Center in Reading. Tickets at the box office, Ticketmaster.com, or 800-745-3000.
This is Lehigh Valley Arts Salon on WDIY FM Allentown, and we are talking about the current exhibitions and new exhibitions at the Allentown Art Museum. And John Pepper is still with me, and we're going to talk just really briefly about another exhibition that opened about a month or so ago and is ongoing. It's Hidden Treasures, American Photography from the Collection, from the Allentown Art Museum's collection. John, tell us a little bit about this particular exhibition.
Well, this exhibit showcases the masterworks of American photography from our collection, from the museum's collection, and these are mostly prints that have never been displayed. So it really is wonderful to see. You can't really have photos on display very often because of curatorial requirements to preserve them. So this is a real rare collection that our curator Diane Fisher put together, mostly prints from the middle decades of the 20th century. So she is emphasizing specific visual unity here, and mostly real masters who speak to each other in some compelling way.
And there are a few masters in there, I believe.
A few masters indeed. Ansel Adams, is a great piece by Ansel Adams, and
Margaret Bourke White.
Margaret Bourke White. If you're not familiar with her, she is a great example of a real go-getter. Her photography was the first cover of Life magazine was a Margaret Bourke White photograph.
Yep.
And someone who lives locally is Larry Fink.
Who's been a guest here in the studio for his exhibitions and a good friend of the station. Yeah,
Larry's work, what can I say? This is a piece that is really an early piece by Larry, and he is certainly somebody who has documented our society through so many decades.
Okay, so there's a range of works that have not regularly been put, they're in the museum permanent collection, but they can't be on display because of exposure to the light for too long. So
correct.
This is a chance to see some rarities, and it really sounds like there's some great stuff in there. This exhibition runs until?
This is until December 8th.
December 8th, okay. So not quite as long as
right.
the American Wildlife Art, but still time to get down there. Okay, thank you for all of you for coming down and spending time here telling us what's happening at the Art Museum. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all of you coming down. And Lehigh Valley Art Salon, we continue with this month's tasty seasonal recipe.
I'm Maria Filosa from WDIY, and you're listening to Tasty Seasonal Recipes for the Everyday Chef. If you are a gardener or you live near produce farms, you're apt to have a kitchen full of goodness in the way of vegetables and fruits. Now is the time to pack your shelves and freezers with natural goodness that can be enjoyed all through the winter and spring. My garden has been bursting with amazing tomatoes, pumpkins, kale, peppers, and string beans. I can't believe how well everything produced, and I still have more coming, so I needed to get started preserving this bounty right away. One new appliance I purchased this year was a good dehydrator. I have been harvesting kale, cleaning it and drying it, and when it is good and crunchy, I crush it up and put it into canning jars. Sometimes I add seasonings and sauces to it before drying to make delicious kale chips. The crushed up kale is great to add to breads, pastas, stews, and pestos. The kale chips are great for nutritious snacking. My tomatoes usually get stored a few different ways. I either make them right into a sauce and then freeze bags or containers for quick and easy meals, or if I am running short on time, I will cut them up and freeze them raw. They make good additions to stew. The tomatoes can also be sliced and seasoned, then dehydrated like sun-dried tomatoes. I love having roasted peppers on my sandwiches, so an easy way to get jars of peppers is to layer a cookie sheet with foil and nonstick spray, then put your washed peppers in a single layer. Heat the oven to 400 degrees and place them in the center rack. Let cook for 30 minutes, then turn the oven off. Cover the peppers with foil and let them cool until they can be handled. Now, one by one, peel the thin, transparent skin off the peppers with a sharp knife and cut the top off, removing the seeds. Place them into a jar and cover with extra virgin olive oil. You can season them with a bit of garlic powder, too. Store them in the refrigerator or freezer. much better than store-bought. The squash harvest can wait a little bit longer than most vegetables. If I can store them in a cool, dry place, I like to keep the squash whole and fresh until I need it. Others get roasted until soft and pureed right away. I like to freeze them in 2-cup measurements in zip closure bags, since they can be frozen, stacked, and flat, saving freezer space. String beans get washed and blanched in boiling water for a minute, sometimes whole and sometimes cut into bite-sized pieces. Then they are quickly cooled in ice water, drained, and placed in bags in the freezer. Another way is to pickle the string beans. You can buy a bag of pickling spices, and the recipe is right on the bag. Usually, the only other ingredients are water and vinegar. These are made in canning jars. A large pot is needed for the water bath to seal the canning jars. The water has to cover the jars, and you boil them about 10 minutes. Once removed from the water, you will hear the tops pop, letting you know they are sealed and ready to be put on your pantry shelf. For any abundance of fruit, I peel and slice whatever it is and put it into a saucepan with some lemon juice and sugar. After cooking it for about 20 minutes, I let the fruit cool, then put it into containers for the freezer. It is important to have an idea of what you'd like to make before freezing the fruit, since the amount of sugar and also the amount put into the container will be necessary elements. Some fruits, such as strawberries and blueberries, can be frozen raw, while others, like apples, pears, and peaches, store better cooked. So start preparing your excess harvest and produce purchases now, and you will enjoy fresh, natural food for months to come. I'm Maria Filosa. Thanks for listening to Tasty Seasonal Recipes for the Everyday Chef. Have a bountiful day.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, At the Movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of the Press.
When it comes to psychological thrillers, Prisoners takes no prisoners. Prisoners, paced by an intense, carefully crafted, and completely believable performance by Hugh Jackman, is a tension-filled nail-biter with a plot twist that you probably won't see. Keller Dover, played by Hugh Jackman, is a middle-class father living in western Pennsylvania. He owns his own remodeling business. He and his wife, Grace, played by Maria Bello, have a teen son, Ralph, played by Dylan Minnette, and a young daughter, Anna, Erin Gerasimovich. They visit their neighbors, Franklin and Nancy Birch, played by Terrence Howard and Viola Davis, for Thanksgiving dinner in the subdivision where they live. The Birches have two daughters, Eliza, played by Zoe Bordy, and Joy, played by Kyla Drew Simmons. During the visit, the youngest daughters, Anna and Joy, disappear when they are playing outside. Police Detective Loki, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, brings in a suspect, Alex, played by Paul Dano, for questioning. Alex owns the RV that was parked in the vicinity. Alex cannot be held because of a lack of evidence. Canadian Denis Villeneuve is directing from a screenplay by Aaron Guzikowski. Prisoners is an ensemble piece, and each of the lead actors, as well as the supporting actors in the small cast, are excellent. Hugh Jackman, in full beard and flattened hair, disappears into the role. He's unrecognizable. He doesn't seem to be at all the same person who starred as Valjean in Les Miserables or had the lead in The Wolverine. Jake Gyllenhaal gives a reined-in, thoughtful, sincere performance as a beleaguered police investigator. Look for a possible Oscar supporting actor nomination for Gyllenhaal and a possible actor nomination for Jackman. Maria Bello plays a desperate housewife with believability. Viola Davis and Terrence Howard are fine as the other couple coping with the kidnapping of a child. Paul Dano makes yet another indelible impression as a suspect in the kidnapping. Melissa Leo plays one of those middle-class ciphers with incredible depth and understanding. Prisoners goes inside a story that is every parent's worst nightmare and makes it real. On another level, Prisoners is a cautionary tale about what can happen when one tries to take the law into one's own hands. Prisoners is MPAA rated R for disturbing violent content including torture and language throughout. Opening October 11, Captain Phillips. The drama is based on the true story of Captain Richard Phillips and the 2009 hijacking by Somali pirates of the first American cargo ship to be hijacked in 200 years. Paul Greengrass directs Tom Hanks as Phillips in what is sure to be an Oscar-nominated role. Machete Kiss. Robert Rodriguez directs the sequel. Machete is recruited by the United States government to take down an arms dealer who wants to launch a weapon into space. Danny Trejo, Alex Vega, Mel Gibson, and Jessica Alba star. The Fifth Estate. Bill Condon directs Benedict Cumberbatch as WikiLeaks leader Julian Assange in the drama based on real events, Romeo and Juliet, Haley Steinfeld and Douglas Booth star in the romantic drama based on Shakespeare's play. I'm Paul Wallerstein of the Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.
You have been listening to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon on WDIY FM Allentown. Up next, take charge of your life.